Okay, hello. I'm John Sherman, and I am tickled pink to be here with you. Very happy to see you all here, and very happy to be speaking with you. I, of course, have no idea what time it might be where you are, but it's afternoon and a beautiful day here in Ojai. I hope it is beautiful where you are. We just finished, on Tuesday, we just finished our annual five-day retreat here in Ojai, which we've been doing now for, I don't know, 7 or 8 years, I guess. I think this is the eighth or ninth one that we have actually done. And these annual retreats that become an annual event, these annual retreats I always look forward to, and I always welcome as an opportunity to speak to you all, those at the retreat and those who will, those who I will speak to in the future, is with my expression somewhat sharpened and clarified by the work at the retreat. These retreats are an opportunity for me to try to kind of sum up what I've seen and what I've learned in the last year in being in this conversation with you about the possibility of being finished with fear and anxiety and the perceived need to do something to change your life or to change your identity or to change your characteristics or to change what you want and what you don't want or any of those things. This year, more so even than many times before, I have, over the course of this year leading up to this retreat, I have seen much more clearly than ever before the actual role of the old spiritual teachings in our lives and in our desire to be free, to be done with needing and trying to get and trying to get rid of. And as I have always suspected, the old spiritual teachings, the sutras and shastras and hymns and scriptures and sermons and mantras and paths and stages of the paths and so forth and so on, are actually have turned out to be of very little use to us. Very little use to us over the, what has it been now, 3 or 4,000 years that we have been attending to them. It's always been clear to me that the effectiveness of these teachings and these suggestions, these insights, these understandings, these practices, these paths and stages of the path, are very minimal. It seems that of all the billions and billions of people who have lived and have had the opportunity, whether they actually came in contact with them or not, at least were present in the world at the time that these teachings have been uttered and transmitted and spread throughout the world of humanity, that of the billions and billions of us who have heard of these and have been at least present here, available to be touched by them, almost none of us have actually actually known the promise, actually have seen the fulfillment of the promise that underlies all of the spiritual work and all of the spiritual teachings whatsoever. The promise that I can be either free in this life of the idea that I need to fix myself, or I can be somehow redeemed or saved or made clear in my mind. Very few, exceedingly minuscule sample of humanity has actually had much in the way of a fulfillment from attending to and following all of these teachings. Now, this doesn't mean that the teachings are wrong or bad. They're actually quite beautiful, and they are actually clearly a genuine attempt to communicate to us, to all of us, what is seen in the mind that has stumbled upon reality, has stumbled upon the reality in which the fearfulness and the need to construct and maintain an identity has vanished, just vanished. And there are well-intended and earnest and honest attempts to communicate to the rest of us what they see so clearly. And for the most part, they've just kind of failed at that. They have certainly excited us and inflamed our desire for the freedom and the liberation that they seem to offer. But very few actually have found an end to this in their lifetime, an end to the fearfulness, an end to the conviction that I am at stake here, that I am at risk here, that I am in danger here, that I have to be very, very careful about what I think and what I want and what I don't want. I have to be very, very careful about what I do and what my attitude toward things is. They've done us very little good. There have been in the past, prior to the appearance of the teachings in what I've come to call the age of the Upanishads, the age that we live in now, really, the age that has persisted for the last 2,500 years since the beginning of the announcement of the Upanishads, the beginning of the closing of the chapter of the Vedas as the guiding light and the guiding instruction as to how to live our lives and how to be happy and how to be in tune and in touch with things. So I've come to the conclusion that there is little usefulness whatsoever in approaching the issue of human suffering from the standpoint of the traditional and ancient teachings about the nature of reality and about our relationship to it and about what we can do to be free to actually reap the fruits of, the promise of, that life seems to hold for us, to be finished with the idea that we are at risk and at stake and on the edge of extinction, and instead be open to what life offers. I've come to see that the root cause of the entire phenomenon of the misery and suffering and ignorance and heartache that seems to be the nature of human existence, that the root cause of it is not anything we have done, not any real mistake that we have made. It's not because we want the wrong things. We're not bad people because we want to be free. We're not unworthy of freedom because we want freedom. It's nothing we've done. It's nothing that where the reality of things is self-evident and we've just willfully and blindly refused to see it. It is, in fact, the cause of heartache and misery and suffering and the need to create an identity and the need to maintain an identity and keep it pure and true and all the things that we try to keep it. The root cause of that is the initial, immediate, instant of the awakening of self-consciousness as self-consciousness appears in consciousness at our birth. It's at our birth. It's at our birth in this form, in these bodies, in these mines and so forth, for which we are absolutely unprepared. I mean, we come into being in that instant. There's no way we can be prepared for having appeared within this storm of sensory experience and energetic movement and the evolutionary unfolding that is consciousness itself. Our initial response, our initial blind reaction is to pull back, to try to escape from the what seems to be the madness of life and consciousness, to find a place where we can stand, a place where we can be safe and secure, a place from which we might even be able to get what life seems to promise. And from that instant, from that moment, from that, and it's not that we know what's happening. We don't even have words. We don't even have memory. We don't even have concepts. We don't have anything at all except undefined consciousness of being, self-consciousness, the awareness of self. And no tools or learning or understanding or history or any of that whatsoever. So we kind of assume a mental fetal position and try to hold off the onslaught of energy and sensory experience and just the wildness of this ocean of consciousness into which we have appeared. And we start working on trying to develop an identity that can survive here and flourish here, and actually do well here. We try to figure out what we should be and what we shouldn't be, what we should think and what we shouldn't think, what we need to do and what we need not to do, what's right and what's wrong, what's good and what's bad. We first have to figure out what it is that actually seems to give us some satisfaction, some possibility of fulfillment, and then pursue that, become that. This is the identity project. This is something that begins in the instant of the birth into this life, this project to create, perfect, and maintain an identity in which we can be safe and secure from life's, from the whips and scorns of life, from the changefulness of life, what seems to be the swamp that is the floor that we try to stand on in life. Of course, we never succeed. Never. For most of us, most of the billions of us who have known the experience of self-consciousness as a human being, for most of us, we just go helter-skelter, one step at a time, fighting every step of the way, headed for the grave. Some of us, a very small minority of us, many of us happen upon religious teachings, and many of us turn understandably and actually kind of intelligently to rest in the religious promises and the arms of God and so forth, because it's actually pretty easy to do. A vanishingly small portion of us come to hear about these teachings that promise not redemption so much, not salvation from life and the initiation into a perfect afterlife, but the possibility of actual realization of freedom and freedom from fear in this life. The teachings, the spiritual teachings that have appeared in actually all traditions throughout the world, throughout the history of the world, in the religions, it appears primarily in the mystical teachings that are present in all of the religions, Christianity and Islam and Judaism and Buddhism, in all of them. and we hear about these things, and they resonate, they ring true with us. And the reason they ring true with us is because they start out as earnest and honest and heartfelt attempts to speak something, to communicate something about the reality that those who have stumbled upon it have seen. The reality in which nothing is actually as it seems. The reality in which there is no, there's no one at stake here. There's nothing happening here that can possibly cause harm. The reality in which we are as these human creatures, appearances within the vast evolutionary unfolding of consciousness itself, of which us as creatures, self-aware creatures, are ourselves an evolutionary event, an evolutionary arising. And we happen upon these teachings that seem to ring true because they are actually spoken from the heart of the truth, from the heart of reality, and we go to them and we congregate around them and we cling to them and we just know, we understand what they're talking about, and we know how we should feel and how we shouldn't feel, and we manage to fold the whole truly radical and uncompromising reality of which these teachings are speaking, we manage to fold this into the identity project that has occupied us from the moment of our birth. So that now we know what we should be. We should be enlightened. We should be self-realized. We should be liberated from the idea of life as a problem. And we have spread before us a huge range of possible ways in which we can pursue this new goal, the goal of self-realization, the goal of awakening or enlightenment or whatever the tradition we happen upon calls this spiritual success, the success of the spiritual aspiration. And, you know, some of us, a very small number of us, caught in the web of spiritual teaching and spiritual aspiration and the desire for attainment and the desire for freedom and the desire for enlightenment, a very small number of us, just by sheer luck, happened to stumble upon reality and try to speak of it, try to share what's seen with others who seem to be miserable and in pain. But having no context in which to speak about this other than the spiritual context that harkens back to the Upanishads or in the same general time in history, having no way to speak about it, no vocabulary, no social context, no education, no acculturation, no conditioning that gives us a context from which we can speak freshly without honoring these old ways of speaking about it, that themselves are no doubt inaccurate renderings of something that was heard differently than it was said when it was written down. And so we continue the same old, same old. You do not exist. You are inexistent. You are emptiness. You are empty awareness. You must be like that. You must be disinterested. You must be dispassionate about life, about the things that come and go in life. You must be mindful. You must find ways of fixing your minds, because it is your mind, of course, that must be that which enlightenment strikes. It's your mind, your thoughts, your history, the way you look at things, the context in which you view, from which you view things, that that must be struck by enlightenment or realization or any of the other names that we have for that. We don't know any better. We do the best we can, and we don't know any better. But Ramana stumbled upon reality, not as something that occurred to him within the context of engaging in some spiritual activity or some spiritual tradition or some spiritual teaching that he could mistake to be the cause of the stroke of luck that hit him. Ramana is beholden to none of those practices, to none of those traditions. Ramana stumbled on this as a 16-year-old boy by lying down and pretending to be dead. Just that, pretending to be dead, pretending that his body was stiffening and life was departing from it, and not as a result of having heard that through some spiritual expression or some spiritual tradition, but as a result of having the idea himself spontaneously arise. So that Ramana, and don't get me wrong, Ramana wasn't a saint, and he wasn't infallible, and he wasn't anything other than a human being like you and I, who stumbled upon reality, and then tried, once he was tracked down and kind of hogtied and made to, then tried as best he could to say something true to us about what had happened to him and how we could perhaps have the same result from what he took to be the method that he had used. What I've seen in this year really clearly is that it's not that the old spiritual teachings are bad, and it's not that they are they have some sacredness to them that must be honored, so that we have to stick with them no matter whether they are effective or ineffective, but just that they are attempts by those who have stumbled upon reality to say something to us who still writhe about in the idea that we are trapped here, that we are at stake here, say something to us that might be helpful to us. And it's just not helpful anymore. So what I've seen is that above all else, the threshold insight that can clear away a considerable amount of confusion is the insight that sees that everything that all of these teachings have been saying, everything that all religion speaks about, everything that all philosophy, psychology, politics, economics, spiritual teachings, enlightenment teachings, the whole realm of everything that's been said about from this standpoint is all commentary about you. Every bit of it is commentary on you. The Upanishads, the Vedas, the Christian scriptures, the Quran, the mystical teachings, the philosophical speculations, the political solutions, the psychological solutions, the artistic solutions, everything whatsoever in this realm is commentary on you. Something being said about you, about what might be useful to you, about what you are in reality, about what you are not in reality, and about what is the road whereby you can rid yourself of the misunderstanding that you are, in fact, at stake here in this life, in danger here in this life, trapped in this life, in this body, in this mind. All about you. Therefore, it seems absolutely obvious to me that since all of this commentary is about you, understanding the commentary can be of no use to you in ridding yourself of the misunderstanding that causes all the problem. Value is pretty much useless except, getting an understanding of these teachings and so forth give us a little satisfaction, and it's pleasurable, and any understanding is a pleasurable thing to receive, but they're just useless in a utilitarian sense. They have nothing to offer, really, nothing whatsoever to offer. Hard as they have tried to be useful, in fact, they have nothing to offer that is of any use to the suffering individual who believes themselves to be trapped in this life, trapped in this body, trapped in this mind, at the mercy of thought, experience, sensation, desire, aversion, and everything else that life throws at us. What is useful here, since it's all about you, is to look at you. I mean, the teachings are all, what little usefulness they might hold, what little possibility of usefulness they might hold, is entirely conditioned upon your ability to actually receive the reality of what was being offered in them, and to be unconfused and distracted by the endless, seemingly urgent need to keep an eye on everything, lest you believe something wrong, or think something wrong, or want something wrong, or want to get rid of something that you should keep. But you, which is what it's all about, you are here. You are never absent. You are never missing. You are always here, always available. And since even the whole misunderstanding, this misunderstanding that says, oh my God, what's going on? I've got to do something. Hold on. Stop everything. Let me figure this out. Let me save myself from the craziness of whatever this is in which I have appeared. You, since even that is about you, that misunderstanding that you are vulnerable and on the line here, and at stake here, and trapped here, and so forth, even that is about you. That is a commentary on you. Even that, even the cause of the problem, even the cause of the misery, is a commentary on you. It seems like the simplest way to settle it is to, well, look at you. Just look at you. By look, I mean, get the perception of you, the direct, immediate experience of the reality of you, which is ever-present, never changes, always the same, always here, ordinary beyond the possibility of actually conveying the profound ordinariness of you. Why not look at you? Just look at you. Surely, if it is true what I say, that all of the suffering and all the misery hinges upon that initial misunderstanding about what you are, the misunderstanding that sees you to be some creature that is caught in a maelstrom of energy and threat and unpleasantness, since that itself is about you, surely looking at you directly should settle that and clear that up once and for all. So that's the vichara. Well, it's the conscious turning toward the vichara. It's a constant conscious turning toward reality, toward you. And sure enough, the longer that I am involved in this work and the more people that I speak with who actually hear what I have to say, and despite all reason not to try, they try, no matter how stupid it might seem or how against everything they've come to believe it might seem, those who try actually to do what I ask them to do pretty much uniformly report after some time, some short time, some long time, pretty much uniformly report that, wow, life is sweet. Life is actually what I've always wanted. That's what I'm here for, is to look at this life, to look at this magnificent unfolding of experience and display and energy and so forth that constitutes consciousness, the unfolding of life, the unfolding of creation. So one thing that has come to me over this past year and that I spoke about quite a bit in the retreat last week is the uselessness of spiritual teachings and the foolishness of the what even I have continued to pay some lip service to the old ways, to the old teachers, and how foolish that is to if we find a way that actually works, then there is no need for us to yearn for or cling to or care about what the old teachings say and don't say. Nor is there any need for us to reject the old teachings and brush them aside and get rid of them because, well, that too is just part of this identity project, part of trying to figure out what I should believe and what I shouldn't believe, what I should think and what I shouldn't think. In the light of the actual direct experience of the reality of what you are, the whole show of concern about my relationship to these teachings, my relationship to this life, my relationship to everything, the whole show of that kind of neurotic entanglement in that just vanishes. Because you are the source, the target, the goal of all of it. You. Just you. Now, trying to tell anybody how to go about looking at their self is a pretty strange is a pretty strange thing to attempt. I mean, it's you I'm talking about, right? It's you. So the best that I can do, and God knows I try, the best that I can do is to see if I cannot spark within you the just a spontaneous arising of the energy of curiosity about what it is I'm talking about when I say, look at yourself. What can I possibly be talking about? And I tell you that if that curiosity arises, if that innocent kind of open-hearted wanting to see what it is that I am pointing to, if that appears in you, it will take you home. That and your own natural intelligence and your power of discernment will take you home. Now, an interesting aspect of this whole business of the conscious vichara, the conscious entry into reality with the attention, interesting thing about this is that in this effort, and it is an effort, in this effort, the way in which your life is unfolding is beside the point. What I mean by that is this. For example, I received an email just this morning about how someone would like to speak to me about the appearance of the recognition of the endless sense of isolation and aloneness that is revealed at the moment, which is what I have spent this whole life trying to avoid. I see that it is a resistance that hooks me deeply and wanted to report and share it with you and others who are no doubt finding similar aspects in this inquiry. Well, here's the deal. In the course of the inquiry, pretty much everything that can arise within you, any kind of misunderstanding, any kind of the sense of isolation and aloneness, the resistance to it, the hook that hangs you deeply, the resistance that hooks you deeply, that resistance, the thing that you are resistant to, the whole complex of activity and relationship and movement toward and movement away from and the thoughts that arise about what should be and what shouldn't be and what peace really feels like and what will happen, shouldn't I not be able to ignore and not resist these things? That whole business is literally beside the point to the vichara. The purpose of the vichara is not to eradicate negative thought. It's not to eradicate feelings of isolation and aloneness. It's not to eradicate feelings of being not isolated and alone either. The purpose of the vichara is to rid you of this fundamental, primal falseness, this fundamental, primal, nonverbal, unseeable belief, this inference that says, I am at risk here. I am at stake here. I have got to do something to keep myself safe and maybe if I get lucky, to make myself available to be struck by life's promise. The purpose of the vichara, the purpose of looking at you, has nothing whatsoever to do with straightening out your life, or straightening out your attitudes, or straightening out your relationships, or straightening out the internal relationships that you have with your mind and the aspects of your mind that come and go and so forth. These things have all come into being in obedience to and in order to try to mitigate and eliminate this underlying sense of fearfulness and anxiety that keeps us forever watching everything, forever trying to figure out what should be here and what shouldn't be here, like isolation and aloneness or resistance, trying to figure out what I should get rid of and what I should keep. These things come into being as part of that entire project, that takes up all of our life, to become something that I should be, to change and to modify and to perfect the way this life unfolds. The vichara has nothing to do with that. The life unfolds on its own. The life unfolds in obedience to the context in which it appears. It changes all the time. There are new experiences, old experiences, new thoughts, old thoughts, new understandings, old understandings, constantly coming and going within the life, within the creature itself. None of this has anything to do with the cause of your suffering. the cause of your suffering is entirely the misunderstanding that says that you are vulnerable, at stake, on the line, at risk, trapped here in this life, this body, this mind. And the vichara, the turning of attention to the vichara, the looking at yourself, since it is your nature that is the subject of that misunderstanding, the direct experience of you does away with that. Evaporates it. Disintegrates it over time. And over time, the life changes, since the context in which the life is unfolding has changed so dramatically when the idea that you are at risk here departs. But that's not the purpose of the vichara. The purpose of the vichara is to rid you of your fear, to rid you of the existential neurotic terror that life is dangerous and a mistake and something needs to be done about it. I'm going to read one more email here, and part of the reason I'm going to read this is because it's the way in which I'm going to reply to this email. This is an email from someone that was in the retreat with me. And all of this that I've said up to now kind of is in order to give you a context in which you can understand what this person's talking about and what I am and how I respond to this. Starts out, "Dear John, first I would like to express my gratitude to you and Carla for this retreat, which I enjoyed very much. Since it seems that you value feedback to keep on improving your skill at inspiring people to look at themselves, I would like to share my experience of this retreat in more detail. Like many others, I find you quite eloquent, especially at cutting through spiritual materialism. However, your repeated talk about spirituality annoys me. I believe it is simply unnecessary, and at times your comments are inaccurate." I'm assuming here that he's talking about my repeated talk about the uselessness of the spirituality of the olden times, not talking about my own ill-conceived attempts to say something, you know, metaphysical and philosophical about the nature of things. He goes on. "For example, when you say that faking death is not a practice when referring to how Ramana stumbled upon reality, well, it is. A number of practices consist in being still and breathing so softly that the movement of the air through the respiratory system becomes hardly noticeable. I also remember a story that Osho told about a tantra teacher literally forcing one of his disciples to remain completely still for several days." Okay. It's not my intention to say that faking death is not a spiritual practice. In fact, I would be stunned if I heard that it was not. It seems so obvious a spiritual thing, this business about death and, you know, the kind of preoccupation with death that spiritual teachings hold within them. It would be really shocking to me if it were not a spiritual practice in some tradition or another, in some way or another. What I'm speaking of when I speak about the fact that Ramana, in pretending to be dead, was not following a spiritual practice, is that whatever spiritual practices there are that contain within that practice of pretending death, Ramana was not familiar with them. If you read Ramana's own account of the events that transpired while he lay there and pretended to be dead and pretended rigor mortis would set in and all of the things that would lead up to death, you will see that this was his own insight that led him to this attempt. And therefore, it's not that the pretense of death is not present in spiritual teachings. it is that that's not what led Ramana to it. And the pretense of death that is present in spiritual teachings is pretty much uniformly aimed at doing something to correct, transform, or transcend the creature's relationship with the idea of its own death. Even pranayama, which is might even be almost a mainstream spiritual practice, has the cessation at the two points of cessation in the breath cycle as being analogous to death. And the aspirant and the practitioner is instructed to be extremely aware of the cessation. The cycle of the pranayama is entirely centered on the two cessation points. I forget their names. I used to know it. But that wasn't Ramana doing that. Ramana was scared he was dying and decided to see what dying would feel like and stumbled on reality. He then, I might add, spent some years, 12 years actually, in total, apparently trying to get some sense of what had happened to him. He hid in the basement of the temples at Tiruvannamalai. We know that he, especially after he left the temple, that he spent some time reading and understanding the old spiritual teachings and so forth, no doubt in order to get some sense of what had happened to him. But the spiritual teachings didn't lead him to reality. Spiritual teachings had nothing whatsoever to do with leading Ramana to reality. This guy also goes on now and says, you also repeatedly state that spiritual practices do not work, and then tell the story of your own experience with a variety of them. But they are just ways to create a gap, which, unrecognized as oneself, is often mistaken to be yet another spiritual experience. In fact, the various ways you, meaning me, use to look at yourself, like focusing on the heart area or the sense of self, are actual spiritual techniques. Well, yeah, I know that. That's where I heard about them, in reading about spiritual techniques. None of them did me much good. And what I do see very clearly is that what you say is true. They are just ways to create a gap. That's the fact. That's the purpose of most of them, is to create a gap, like in pranayama, for example. Now, the usefulness of creating a gap is lost if one doesn't look at that gap in the certain knowledge that what is being seen is you, just you, which has nothing whatsoever to do with any spiritual understanding of you. The spiritual understandings cannot possibly say anything accurate about you. And it is my experience, actually, that rather than when the gap is unrecognized as oneself is often mistaken to be yet another spiritual experience, it is always mistaken to be yet another spiritual experience. The gap, when it's not looked at knowing it to be you, it is the looking at you that does the work, not the accidental appearance of you within some other context, unnoticed and immediately appropriated as some example of some previous spiritual understanding. And I tried a lot of things. In my period of desperation, I tried a lot of things, and it was only sheer luck that I was trying those things, trying to follow Ramana's advice rather than trying to find the advice of the teachings themselves. I was trying to follow Ramana's advice rather than trying to follow the example of the teachings themselves. I was trying to follow Ramana's advice to look at myself. And if you look at yourself, if you look at you, really, in this moment, just look at you, I promise you that you will return to that, and I promise you that the return will bear fruit, and the day will come in the not too far distant future when you see for yourself that this life that has seemed so threatening and so fearful and so fraught, this life will reveal itself to you as just as it is, just as it unfolds in its unpredictability and its wildness and its seemingly contradictory nature. This life, just as it is, will reveal itself to you as everything you have ever wanted. And looking at this creature, this unfolding consciousness, will reveal itself to you as everything you have ever wanted to do. Just looking. Just looking. My friend here goes on, and this is from a person I have a lot of respect for, and I feel very warm and affectionate toward. He goes on to finish up with the fact that the difference with you, he says, is your feedback. Your being alive and your personal experience, which I am so grateful to have come across. And really, that is the difference, you know. I mean, really, it is pretty much a cliche in spiritual circles that dead teachers are of no use to us. That once they're dead and gone and we have nothing but their writings and their lifeless reports of what they said and the opinions of others about what they said, that their usefulness to us is ended. So it's interesting that insight would bubble up, and he would see that the only thing that's really useful and different about me is my the fact that I'm alive and here to talk to you and to try to say more clearly what it is that I really want to say to you, to try to say more effectively and more compellingly what I really want to say to you. When this creature is gone, the things that people say about him and the ideas that come from reading what I might have said or written or anything, all that'll be useless. Just one more bunch of stuff to put into the spiritual grab bag, to put into the sack that we carry around of ideas and spiritual ideas and political ideas and psychological ideas and philosophical ideas, trying to find some guidance and some help in keeping us safe in this life. And he goes on to say, yet whatever you say, it will not prevent some people from reading your books as spiritual scripture and leading to your podcast as spiritual revelations. Well, yeah, nothing I can do about that except to tell you again and again what I have to offer you, what I have to speak to you about has nothing whatsoever to do with any spiritual teaching, understanding, utterance, aspiration, or attainment whatsoever that has ever been spoken about. It has to do with you. Only with you. And if you see that, then you see it all. If you see that all that ever has been spoken about by anybody in an honest attempt to be helpful and be useful is stuff that is said about you, if you really see that, then you must immediately see that the most direct and useful and fruitful and alive way to see what these things are talking about is to look at you. Now, here, in this moment, in any moment, to look at you, to resolve yourself, to look at you and to know that you're doing it. So, we had a wonderful retreat. We talked a lot about the uselessness of spiritual teachings and the uselessness of spiritual practice. We also talked about the usefulness of these things. Mostly, above all, we talked about you. Just you. Look at yourself. Just look. You are not here to understand yourself. You are not here to find out what you should be. You are not here to find yourself. You are not here to become what you should be. You are here to look at yourself. First, at the heart of yourself, the irreducible sense of yourself. To be finished with all of the false ideas about what you are. Not that the ideas necessarily will depart immediately, but you will be finished with them. And then, for the rest of this time, for the rest of the time you are in this life, to do what you're here for, which is to look at you, this endless ocean of unfolding, evolving consciousness, what you're here for, what the whole sense of self-consciousness has come into being to make possible, what this whole evolutionary arising is about, to just look with your eyes wide open, your heart wide open, agape in wonder at the endless magnificence of this creation that is consciousness itself. Just to look. So, I guess that's it. I'm never sure that I actually have succeeded in saying I'm always sure that I have not succeeded in saying what I wanted to say, because if I were successful in saying what I wanted to say, it wouldn't take me an hour to say it. What I want to say is, look at you. Just look. Just look. Look until you are done with the fearfulness, the anxiety, the need to hold your life at arm's length, the need to figure out what you should be and what you should not be. Just look at yourself until all of that is gone, and then you will see that you have never seen anything other than yourself. And you will be finished with the fear of life. Because it's not really the fear of death that causes all the trouble. It's the fear of life. And you'll be finished with the fear of life when you begin looking at yourself. Okay, I'm done. Anybody want to talk to me? I think you know how to go about doing that, I hope. And I'll just be here waiting on you.
We got Don calling from New York.
Don.
John, how you doing?
I'm doing well. It's a pleasure to hear from you, Don. How are you? Can I help you?
I hope so. I must tell you, maybe it's part of the journey. I don't know, but it's almost like it's coming out of my ears. I have an intellectual grasp, maybe even an intuitive grasp of everything you're saying, but when you say, look at yourself, I need I need something more specific. Do I look at, Ramana spoke of strangling the ego. Do I look at the ego, or do I look at the part of me that's remained unchanged? And also, I'm not entirely clear about what happens when this manifestation ends, about death. You know, I've got a lot on my plate here, but the main thing that bothers me is that I seem to be stuck at an intellectual level rather than this experiential and awareness level. I'm getting ticked off and envious of those who have it, and that's not making things any easier, particularly when I read that in the end, ultimately, it's an act of grace, which is a wonderful thing, but it's also a crapshoot, you know. So I just wanted to know if you could be more specific in that self-observation, that looking at yourself, so that I can maybe refine or pinpoint my practice more accurately.
I'll do my very best. First of all, you can forget about that grace stuff. That's another thing that's written about you. All of the things that have your attention riveted are things that are written about you. Now, there is a donness to you, is there not? A donness that's present here that is not intellectual, but is entirely experiential background, the donness of you. Do you hear that?
I've been aware of that my entire life. It's the one thing that never, ever changes.
That's it. You look at that as often as you can. Now, don't misunderstand me. The unfolding of the vichara is not always very short, and it can entail considerable discomfort. As this old identity project begins to lose its foundation and starts falling apart at the seams. But the thing to look at is precisely this donness, just that. And it doesn't require that. See, as a result of our spiritual understandings, I think, those of us who are unfortunate enough to have come to this through a spiritual roadmap. I suspect that it's because of our spiritual understandings that we have a tendency, even in this practice, in this method, in this way of life, we have a tendency to think that what's called for is for there to be an unbroken conscious awareness of reality, which I am calling donness, and that's really not the case. The creature's attention is extremely fickle, and it already, the fact that donness itself is so ordinary and so ever here kind of makes donness the last place that attention will come to rest. So long as there is movement and color and sensation and so forth that are unfolding as the mind, as this sense of individual consciousness, so long as that's going on, attention naturally will recoil from resting in the donness of it all and attend to those things, the thoughts, the ideas, the insights, the understandings, the intuitions, the discomfort, the distress, the irritation, the pleasure, the clarity, all of those things. The really good news is that it's only our spiritual understanding that leads us to believe that what we are seeking is an unbroken awareness, conscious awareness of donness. Actually, we have an unbroken awareness of donness. It just seldom is present in the individual consciousness as an object of experience. But if you look at the donness just whenever you can, and that's all you really need to do is look at the donness And what you will find, by the way, is if you follow Ramana's advice, as I did, to find ego, to grab it by the throat, to not let it go, to strangle it, what will happen as an outcome of that is that whatever discrete sensory experience that you assigned the name ego to and riveted with your attention will disappear in the light of your attention. It will just disappear. And then, if you're like me, you'll go scrambling about looking for where to go and how do I get a hold of it again. But if you're not like me, if you're smarter than me, you will see that what remains when that sensory phenomenal appearance that you have thought to be ego disappears, what remains is donness, just donness. And you see that directly, and then your attention will skitter away. But it is the repeated conscious apperception of donness that does the work. And there's no way to predict or to foresee or no way to know what will be the way in which the collapse of the misunderstanding plays out within your mind, within your life, within the bubble of consciousness that is the sense of individual existence. There's no way to tell. There's no way to predict. There's no way to even guess how that will unfold in the absence of, as the idea that you're at risk here departs. It will change over time, for some quickly, for some not so quickly, but the point of the vichara is not to fix the life. The life gets fixed on its own. It has its own momentum and inertia and so forth. But the point of the vichara is not to fix the life. What happens is we think we are looking for results rather than reality. And what we're actually looking for in the vichara is reality. The result we're looking for is the direct apperception of donness. And there's no immediate, very seldom is any immediate gratifying result from the actual being able to get the direct experience of donness. The results in the life are over time and the winding down of the identity project. But it's the donness that you look at. And it may be, for me, it took a long time, maybe some time before it really dawns on you what has occurred in your life. But it's the donness that you're looking for. Do you follow me?
This has probably been the clearest explanation I've ever gotten. What was revealed to me now is the fact that I've been doing just what you've been talking about. I'll get up and I'll be at work in a situation, just an objectively, a hassling type situation. Why don't I feel better? Why aren't things better? You're right. You're right. I'm looking for Dr. Feelgood, you know, sort of like an alcoholic or a pillhead, rather than looking at the donness, or in your case, the jhanness, which would be the same thing. I'm very easily distracted from that focus back to the same old crap, and I get lost in it. This has been extremely helpful.
Well, I'm really happy that it's extremely helpful, and I'll tell you something, too, that you have obviously been looking at donness. You immediately knew what I was talking about. And even though, and this is something that might be helpful to you over time, is the short-term way in which the life feels has nothing whatsoever to say about how it's going to end up. It may well be that you feel lost in it, that you are, you know, attracted to the thoughts and the ideas and Dr. Feelgood and all of that, but that doesn't matter. You see, trying to get rid of that, looking for results instead of reality, is all part of the identity project. It's all part of the determination to become what I need to be in order to feel good. So I'm really happy to have this conversation with you. Anything else?
I just want to say, I have to bear in mind that the results that I'm seeking are a side effect of the vichara process, and I really have to stop getting on my own case for the fact that I'm not dancing down the street every 5 minutes. It's this has been great. There's very little else to say. And I'm not expecting, you know, enlightenment by next Tuesday, but this is very encouraging.
Well, I'm happy to hear that. The other thing to say, too, is, and I really want you to hear, I mean, you really don't have to keep that in mind. You can, and it may be helpful to you to do so. But the other thing I really want you to hear is that the way in which the life is presenting itself and expressing itself has no effect on the effectiveness of the vichara. That it is the looking that does the work, and it is not immediately reflected in the way the life unfolds. In fact, it might be reflected in making it seem worse for a while. So, what good news to hear from you, Don. Okay?
Okay, John, just one last thing. You and I wrote you an email a few months ago about a past betrayal long ago. You wrote specifically whether or not you resolve that has nothing to do with the ultimate question of resolving whether or not you're at stake here. It was basically these emotional, so-called emotional issues are really non-issues. And I just got that feeling again. I feel very refocused. Thanks again, John.
You're very welcome, Don. I'm really happy that we have this, and for everybody, I'm really happy we have this opportunity to be able to meet together regularly like this so that these things can be discussed and they're useful to everybody. Okay, keep in touch, Don. Let me know how you're doing, okay?
Will do. Thanks, John.
Adrian, calling from Ottawa, Canada.
Hi, Adrian.
Hi, John. Hi, Carla. Hi, everybody.
What can I do for you?
Well, I'll say a couple of things and then you'll comment, of course, as you think fit. The psychological background of my trying vichara is the fear of failing to ever obtain true and permanent fulfillment in my life. It is a fear, and it's something like a deep sorrow or sadness or grief. Now, you have said, I believe, that vichara must not be motivated by a desire to escape life and to obtain instant gratification. But this is, I think, precisely my tendency and my desire. I would like very much to get gratification in this moment. And I know it's not possible, or I think it's not possible. Now, sometimes I do wonder if I ever get beyond a mere lukewarm desire to escape. My experience of relative clarity, those experiences that I consider to have been glimpses, perhaps very pale, very light experiences, perhaps mere glimpses of what the experiences of people like you are. Now, such experiences in my life, I did have a few. They have been momentary. They passed very quickly. On the other hand, my periods of depression, anxiety, when they occurred, were long. They lasted months on end, and they were fairly bad. And I experienced during such periods something, well, I think you may call despair or akin to despair. And, you know, feeling that you are overcome, that you are overwhelmed with despair. I think I now. You say that being motivated by desire to escape or by obtaining peace or something, somehow in the context of vichara, you think that it is wrong and it doesn't serve the purpose of vichara. You don't practice the vichara to experience peace, certainly not immediately. So I'm telling myself sometimes that I only have a very lukewarm desire to escape, I'm also telling myself that I lack the discipline and persistency that some people appear to have, including you, by the way, in practicing anything, whatever you call it, spiritual practices or vichara in particular. That's about everything I wanted to say, waiting for your comments. And thanks a lot in advance for whatever you are going to say.
Well, to begin at the beginning of what you said, the fear of the inability to find fulfillment in life is the flip side of the fear of being harmed and damaged and destroyed by life. The life seems to offer two sides to it. It seems to offer, on the one hand, an endlessly dangerous environment in which I am endlessly at risk and will surely not even survive, even if my life is fulfilling and so forth. On the other side is the sense that we get that life really does offer some promise of profound fulfillment. That life really seems like it ought to be exactly what we have always wanted. And it never lives up to that. And since we have determined that the problem has to do with me not being or doing or feeling or practicing as I should, it is absolutely to be expected that seeming false promise of fulfillment would not be interpreted as a false promise, but rather as a failure on my own part to do or become or understand or get to what I need to be or where I need to be and so forth to make myself available for that fulfillment. So the fear of inability to find fulfillment is exactly at the core of the appearance of this misunderstanding about my nature, which is the misunderstanding that has my nature as being a creature unexpectedly thrust into a maelstrom of a sensory experience and energy and movement and so forth, in a circumstance which seems to be fraught with great terror and great hope. And it's the great hope part that you speak of when you speak of the fear of the inability to find fulfillment. The thing that the fear of inability to find fulfillment and the fear of extinction have in common is that they are both opinions about your nature, that you are the one who can be wiped out or you are the one that can find fulfillment or fail to find fulfillment. And since they are both misunderstandings about your nature, the only solution to that is to have the direct experience of the reality of your nature, which in and of itself, without any intellectual understanding of what's happened, although that may come, and without any understandings or intuitions or insights whatsoever, looking at the reality of what you are should in and of itself automatically eliminate any misunderstandings about what you are over time. And that's the whole of the practice of the vichara, so that it has nothing whatsoever to do with whether, and this is interesting, I really want to make this clear. The search for gratification will always fail. It doesn't make any difference. Well, it won't always fail. Every once in a while we happen upon some substance or some activity that seems to provide some fleeting and limited gratification. But the search for profound and fundamental and ultimate gratification will always fail. And it doesn't make any difference what we are doing in order to accomplish that. It will always fail. That's just the way it is. There is no... It presupposes the condition of the first misunderstanding, which is the condition that says, I need to find fulfillment. I need to do something, become something, understand something, practice something that will bring me fulfillment. When all of the great ones have told us, and let me join my voice with them, not so great voice, have told us that fulfillment is here, always, not absent, not missing. And it's only our perception that is mistaken. And as it turns out, the perception that is mistaken is the perception as to our nature, which can be eliminated by looking at the reality of our nature. Now, and I point that out as often as I can. If I have said that the vichara must not be based on a search or an effort to find gratification, then I misspoke myself, because the vichara actually can be motivated by anything at all. It's not the motivation that counts, really. I mean, it's not the motivation that counts. If I try to look at myself thinking based on my past spiritual understanding that I will find enlightenment as a result of looking at myself, so long as what I'm trying to do is look at myself to get the direct experience and apperception of the reality of what I am, what I think will come of that is absolutely beside the point. Anything that brings you to the determination to get the direct experience, the irreducible actual experience of the reality of what you are, it is that will do the work. It is the direct knowing experience of the reality of what you are that will do the work. No matter what initially may have given rise to it. And you can see, right, that, or I think you ought to be able to see, that what you speak of as glimpses is not glimpses of you. It's glimpses of understanding of all of this that has been said about you. It's glimpses of states that are actually attainable. The states of the feeling of emptiness and open-heartedness feeling of dispassion and so forth, feelings of no mind, no thought. These are actually attainable. And there are glimpses that can come as a result of the involvement in spiritual practices that are glimpses of those states. But the thing about them is that if, whether they are glimpses or long-standing, long-lasting states, the thing about them that is different from you is that there was a time when they were not here, and then there is a time when they are here, and then there is a time when they are no longer here. For some, the period when they are here is very brief indeed, which is, I think, what you speak of when you speak of glimpses. These glimpses can't hurt you. They can't help you. They are beside the point. They are play in this life. There's not wrong. They can't do you any damage whatsoever. And wanting them to come back can't do you any damage whatsoever. Thinking that you are insufficiently disciplined, that can't do you any damage whatsoever. Nor can the seeking after further discipline hurt you or help you. nor can the seeking after a longer duration for these glimpses hurt you or help you. The actual direct, immediate experience and apperception of the reality of what you are is a very fleeting matter, as I was speaking to Don about just a moment ago. It's a very fleeting matter. The attention is very fickle. And since what you are is what you always have been, and since you have never been absent, since there's never been a single nanosecond of time in this entire life when you have not had the reality of what you are within your awareness, as you try to escape from it, as you try to build a fortress around it or a fortress around yourself, attention naturally is not going to be very interested in that. It's interested more in the memories of glimpses that have passed and the suspicion that you're not up to the task and that you shouldn't be seeking gratification and all of that, than to rest for any length of time whatsoever on the absolute unmoving certainty of being that is you. The thing that is absolutely different, that stands apart from every other thing in the entire universe of mind and individual consciousness, is unlike everything else, you are never not here. You are never absent. Unlike everything else, you are absolutely in a way that can be said about nothing else, absolutely, totally, unrestrainedly certain that you are. That you are, and that you are here. There is nothing whatsoever that can ever persuade you that you are not. So long as there's breath in this body, nothing can persuade you that you are not. Nothing. You can be persuaded that I am an illusion, a hallucination, an artifact rising in your mind and your brain and so forth. You can persuade yourself that your body is that. You can persuade yourself even that your thoughts and your mind and so forth are that. But about you, it is absolutely impossible for you to persuade yourself that you do not exist, that you are not here. That's what you look at. You look at the unmoving, unmistakable, to coin a phrase, Adrian-ness of you. The you, just you. And it is of no consequence, your discipline or lack of discipline, your infatuation with gratification or your indifference to gratification, your fear of the inability to find fulfillment. That's the direct result of the misunderstanding that will go as you look at yourself. There may or may not be spiritual experiences that arise in the course of this practice. They are beside the point. There may or may not be fulfillment and the coming of fulfillment and the losing of fulfillment and all of that that seem to accompany the enactment of the vichara, which is you looking at you. They are beside the point. They come and go. You remain. The whole problem is a misunderstanding about you, that you had nothing to do with, that you had, there was no way in the world that you could avoid or prevent, but there is a way now to snuff it out, extinguish it. And it is not, and it is by just looking at you. And it doesn't matter why you look at you, as long as you are looking at you with knowledge that you are looking at you, everything comes out right. So all the rest of it, beside the point. Really, beside the point. You follow me?
Yes, I am. And I think what you are saying is a little bit, shouldn't say clarifying, but certainly encouraging. I would like also to point out that you always seem to pay attention to everything I'm saying. I guess it's true for what other people are saying to you. You pay a lot of attention and you address each and every nuance of what we are saying, and thanks a lot for that.
You're very welcome. And I'm really happy. I think that the fact that you say that it is encouraging is an indication that it's useful to you. There's no need to have an understanding of how it's useful to you. There's no need even to have that big an understanding of what it is that I'm saying, so long as you look at you, because that's all I'm ever saying, look at you. So I'm really happy for this conversation with you, Adrian. Please keep in touch, okay?
I will certainly keep in touch with you, John. Thanks again, and all the best to you and Carla.
You're very welcome. Anybody else?
Vanky, calling from North Carolina.
Hi, Vanky. How are you?
Hey, John. Hey, Carla. I'm doing good. John, so I think for the first time in all this mess, I have what feels to me like an original question. It seems like a question that I want to ask, as opposed to what we have been said or programmed into asking. And I just want to preface real quick, and I'll ask you the question, and hopefully you can tell me if it makes sense or if it has any logical fallacy. Before, I had the tendency to preface all these questions with my background of doing the inquiry in whatever form, and look to my life as the temperature of how it is doing, how the inquiry is doing, or as an indicator of how it's doing. And now the tendency is not there, and that's pretty, that feels good. But I think there's a more important question underlying here. I saw that I had a tendency to look to thought and experience for the answer. And even when you said you are here, look at you, I would always try to process that that through the mind, and something different happened. I realized that I was trying to recreate a couple of whatever mystical experiences that I may have had or have imagined myself to have had. And for example, when you said, look at if you're here or not, my mind would just look at, I don't know, maybe the sky in front of me, and I would go, am I there in that sky or the star or something completely absurd. But the other day something broke, and this question to me personally feels like the closest match to what you have been saying. When you say, I am here, look at you, the concept of distance came into my head, and it said, I am the closest to me, you know, it is the closest thing I can imagine. So it is not somewhere out there in terms of distance, but the distance is the least. I mean, it might, in spiritual terms, it might be like kind of dualistic to say I am the closest to me, but you know, more closer than breath or being or something like that. I see that this feeling of me is the closest to me. And for me, the vichara has not become, I am here, look at that, or are you not here? But it has become a different instruction. It has become, stay close. And I don't know if that makes, if there's any logical fallacy or anything in that, but stay close is what it has become. And of course, all the attempts to explain it are attempts to go away from that. You know, in terms, an attempt to put a distance between the two. And this one is, you are closest to yourself, so stay close, it has become. And all thoughts are therefore beside the point, like you say, because they all like take you away from you, so to speak. And yeah, so my question is that stay close, this, that I am talking about, the same as having the direct experience of you?
Well, yeah. I mean, it certainly is true that there's not so much as the thickness of the film of a soap bubble between you and you. And so, you know, here's the thing. I remember when I was in prison and determined to try to, once and for all, actually what I thought would happen as a result of my my crazy efforts at the Vichara at that time, I thought what would happen would be I'd break myself of the idea that there was anything to me other than this body, this mind, and that what I thought would happen is that I would discover that actually it's just the human condition, and it's part of the human condition to yearn for and invent ways to escape from the human condition. And during that time, I tried a lot of different ways to enact what I felt to be what Ramana was trying to say to us. And I don't think that's one of them, but many others, you know, like I would walk around the compound and in my mind would be running like I'm a little reluctant to say this lest I trigger something, but it didn't hurt me. In my mind would be running the kind of like a japa. Here. 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 And I found that to be useful to me. I never got to the stay close, but that sounds entirely appropriate and understandable to me. I can hear that very clearly. The thing to be seen about this, though, is not what the particular thought patterns, the particular thought forms might be that are useful to you, the sense of individual consciousness at this time in the unfolding of the vichara within you. What's really interesting and really exciting is not those individual thought forms, but the fact that it's only the desire to look at yourself that's required, and whatever's needed, whatever techniques or little thoughts and so forth that's needed to bring you to that will appear. And that the test of them is not whether they make some consistent sense with some construction that I have created about what this is and how it should be and how it should proceed and so forth. The only test of it is whether or not, in so doing, you return to this direct experience and apperception of the reality of you, the venkiness of you. I like that, venkiness. I actually got that from Carla when we were when I was talking to Don. And, but, do you follow me? So this is wonderful. This is wonderful, and perhaps someone else will find something useful in this as well. Okay?
Yes, John, I understand what you said about the thought patterns. I mean, whatever thought pattern is useful, but this point you made about the desire to look at oneself needs to exist, and all the other endeavors that cause pain or disinterest or desperate craving for distraction is the precise reluctance to look at oneself. That's what I mean. It sounds like a metaphysical statement to make, but it seems like it's the reluctance to look at oneself that creates the desperate craving for distraction. And what it really feels like, the words that best come to me to just have this direct experience, which is staying here, which is also looking in a contrived kind of way, in a way I cannot logically explain, I have seen them quoting Ramana a lot, and being from South India, I know they have made him into a saint and all that, and it's really ridiculous what they do with Ramana, but abide is probably the best word I can think of for what is here without its spiritual connotation. So hopefully I make myself clear. So anyway, thanks for your response, John.
Well, anyway, thanks for you, Venky. Yes, you're right. And all of the whole thing is, you see, here's the thing, right? The appeal that all of these things hold for us is the appeal that they have to the whole project of the creation, cultivation, perfection, and maintenance of an identity. And we are so accustomed to those things that, yes, we do exactly, precisely, you're absolutely 100% right. The reason that we pay so much attention to these thoughts and these ideas and these all of this, the whole thing about the content of the mind, is precisely because we're scared to death to look at ourselves. We're scared to death to look at ourselves lest we find out that we are not. So thank you, Venky. Keep in touch, okay?
One more thing, real quick, John. This is another question that popped into my head. Okay, this part of staying with the self or looking at yourself is considerably easier than what it was like a year ago, maybe. But this identity construction project is never-ending. And it's not uncomfortable that it's never-ending, but it's a complete ongoing process. And apparently, it seems to me like life is the identity construction project.
In a sense, that's true. What is subtracted from it is the sense of personal urgency to it, the personal neurotic fearfulness that I will fail or I won't do it right and I will therefore be extinct. But yeah, you're right. Of course it is. What else would it be? That's part of the wonder of it. But when that personal sense of urgent need departs, then the identity project itself is quite delightful. And not very interesting, because it really is not take an awful lot of intellectual or philosophical or spiritual understanding to just kind of casually keep track of the identity project and how it's going. And it also does not contain within it some neurotic velcroedness to some particular aspect of identity, because you are identity. That's what you are. You're not an identity. You are identity. You are the appearance of the of identity in the unfolding, evolving field of consciousness and so forth. And you bestow identity on everything. That's exactly what we do. We look at something, we look at a sensation, and we call that an itch. That's a bestowing of identity on that sensation in that moment, in that context. We look at another sensation and we call it cold. That's the bestowing of identity on that particular phenomenal arising at that time in that context. So in that sense, it is always ongoing, and it's quite playful and no problem to anybody, right?
Right. I mean, minus the sense of personal urgency, which you put it perfectly, as usual. Somehow you seem to do that. Minus the sense of personal urgency, it is natural. It is just natural. It's just a thing that we do, and there is no sense of, like, effort involved. And that's actually beautiful. It's the perfect description of it, I think. And this is bringing new things, or rather, it is bringing familiar things back in a sense of saying to me every day. And my much love to you and Carla, John. Thank you. Yeah.
And you as well, Venky. I understand from Carla we have three more, and then we're going to call it. Whoever the three are who are in line, I'll speak with you, and then we'll say adios.
Eden.
Hi, Eden. What can I do for you?
Hi, John. So I've listened to what everyone has to say today, and I really appreciate everyone's input. And I love the reading of the letter. That was quite humorous, too, also. My experience at this time is feeling, there's a deep feeling of loss. In terms of the Vichara, my very first report to you was that it was going quite well, and that was during the summer. I had spent time in another physical location, and for myself, this looking started to become so I don't know if established would be the correct word, but it became so just, it was just very clearly there that I started to actually have a physical sensation of my eyeballs looking inward. And I don't know if you've ever talked about that or looked or know what I'm referring to, but for me this became quite significant, and the looking became so much less, there was no effort to the looking, it was very effortless. And along with that, just whether it's coincidentally or not, there was a lot of bliss. And for me, that felt like I was truly at something, I'm going to say in quotes, was like the center of my being. Since I've left that physical location and now I'm in the center of my family, which always tends to feel like there's a lot of dissonance in that location, the looking feels like it's just so difficult, and the physical sensation with the eyes is gone, and I just feel like, you know, kind of helpless. Not that that's the only reality, it's a feeling. And I am aware that something that has been more established is still established, but it just feels very far away, or I don't know. I'd like to see what you have to say at this point anyway.
Funny you should say that about eyeballs looking inward. I actually spoke about that during the retreat this week. I spoke to people about the fact that feeling like my eyeballs were turned around in my head, pointed to the back, was one of the experiences that were very vivid and that I remember very well. That experience, of course, comes and goes. It is an interpretation, actually, of what's happening as we seek to look at ourselves. But it's interesting to me that you should have had the same interpretation for a time as I did. Now, it is clear to me that your report that what is established is established is actually the case. I am certain that it feels to you as if it has gotten far away. I am also very familiar with that as well. The feeling states that come and go in life over time, that seem to have as their cause something happening in the present, or something being done to one, or something that I have done, or, you know, something like that. The feeling states that come, such as hopelessness, a feeling of loss, bliss, bliss to feeling state. These feeling states, they come and go without regard to the establishment and the continued effectiveness of the vichara now that it actually has been established in your consciousness and your sense of individual existence. The feeling states that come and go are, there's no way to predict or to project how the interior sensibility will unfold as a result of the vichara. What is absolutely possible to predict is that it will be impossible to predict, and that it may well be, and I know this very well myself, be accompanied by feeling states of hopelessness, especially if, when you find yourself in a set of circumstances that are different from the set of circumstances that went before. Feelings of hopelessness, of loss, of the farawayness of the vichara. All of these things are to be expected, and that even the feelings of bliss that accompanied the what seemed to be the actual effect of the vichara. Bliss is not an effect of the vichara. Bliss is a feeling state that comes. The effects of all of these feeling states are impossible to tease out. The cause of all these feeling states are impossible to tease out of the thread of the unfolding of this individual creature that is eaten. The vichara, the effect of the vichara on the feeling states and the way that the life unfolds and the way that it feels, that its interior sensibility and stuff, is very simple, and its effect is very powerful, but it cannot be predicted that the results of it in the short term will have any particular, any definable characteristics at all. The effects may well be the feeling of hopelessness and loss, feeling of dullness, feeling of having gotten away from it. It may well be feelings of bliss and peace and contentment and so forth. But the role that the vichara plays in the shifting of the feel of being in this life, the role that the vichara plays doesn't have a directly discernible link to the feeling states that are unfolding. The role that the vichara plays is to gradually eat away the underlying foundation of everything that we have been doing previously in our life. The underlying foundation that is premised on the conviction that I am at stake and at risk here, that I'm trapped here, that I need to figure out what I need to be and what needs to be here and what needs to go in order for me to survive this experience of life. The very foundation of that whole project is disintegrating, and it's disintegrating without the appearance of any gross phenomenal sensation whatsoever. It's just disappearing. And as that disappears, the way in which the life shapes itself and presents itself and the states in which it that come and go within it, they will all change. And they are headed toward some new settling into a new point of view that will that doesn't require being founded upon a deeply urgent, emergent need to do something, to make sure that what I have is bliss and what I have is not the feeling of loss, to find peace and contentment and all of that. The the shape of the life as it finally settles, and it will never entirely settle because it is like everything else in consciousness, endlessly at the mercy of the forces in which it appears, the context in which it appears. But the shape of the life as it eventually settles can't be predicted. But it certainly will not be a shape that requires you to worry about whether or not there's a problem with feeling the sense of hopelessness and loss, or a problem with the feeling of the vichara being at a distance rather than close in, or any of that. But the foundation of the way the life has been is being disintegrated. The most powerful force that has shaped this life and this consciousness and this creature is disappearing. So it's to be expected that there will be, you know, consequences. There will be states and so forth that come and go that are welcome, states and so forth that come and go that are unwelcome. The one thing that remains the same, that is unaffected by states, by comings and goings, by confusion, by clarity, by bliss, by a feeling of loss, the one thing that stays the same, that never changes, is the thing about which these states are speaking, which is you. And it's always possible for you. It doesn't have to be. You know, it's not like something where you have to increase the duration or worry about how long you have this direct apperception of the reality of yourself. It's not like that. It is always possible for you to take half a second and taste this, eating this to you. Taste this. Look at it. And what I suspect is now impossible for you to do is to shut down the unfolding evolution that is the work of the vichara in your life. Do you follow me?
I do, although I guess I would just say honestly that I was very attached to that place when, you know, I was having the physical experience of the eyeballs looking inward, and it wasn't because of that physical experience. I'm not attached to that, but it was that what was there was such equanimity that honestly it didn't matter what feeling or state I would experience. Anything could come or go because in that wherever it was that I was, I was just so unmoving, and honestly, when I say there's bliss. There was bliss. That's what I mean. It wasn't the bliss that comes or goes. It was that the unmovingness was so... There's just nothing in life to me that has ever compared to that. And now it feels like it's gone. I know that's not the truth, but I don't know. There's something else, but I'm just not quite.
Are you gone? Have you departed?
Well, I'm going to say no, but it sort of feels like I have.
What has departed is an aspect of the identity that you've worked on all your life. That's all. It has had, like the feeling of the eyeballs turned back in your head, and the feeling of equanimity, and the absolutely profound equanimity. These are feeling states that have come that are more accurately reflective of reality than all the other feeling states that have come. But the fact that it was not here, and then it was here, and then it's gone, is a clear indication that it was a feeling state. It was a feeling state that was a very powerful reflection of reality, but a feeling state nevertheless. It doesn't make it bad. It doesn't, and even your attachment to it is not bad and cannot hurt you. And you can tell this by right now, as we speak, just, are you not here? Have you left? Is not the you-ness of you the same as it has always been? You can look and see. You don't have to rely upon the memory of what was. You don't have to rely upon the understanding of what was. You are here. You are absolutely here. You are not absent. You are not missing. You are present. And you see one of the great lessons in this seeing, and I tell you that it's all going to turn out right for you. But one of the great lessons in this seeing is that you were absolutely unhelped by the whole period of that profound and fundamental equanimity. And you have been absolutely unheard by the whole period of the feeling of the loss of that equanimity. Now, if you look in the bubble of consciousness that is this creature, if you look in that for confirmation of that, you will not find it. But you are here. You're not missing. You're not absent. And you have not changed as a result of any of it. You can see that. You can look at that. The experience and the apperception itself might be a nanosecond at time. But you'll see. You see that you are here. You are the same. The point is not to transform your life into reality, because life is the endlessly shifting, changing evolution of consciousness in the world. The point is not to transform your life into reality. It is to rid yourself of the idea that you are affected, harmed, hurt, helped, enhanced, diminished, in any way whatsoever by anything that takes place in life. And the only way to do that is to look at you. You hear me?
I hear you, John. I love both you and Carla. I'll just keep looking because I trust you. And I trust myself. I'm noticing that what is so disconcerting is that this feeling of despair or whatever it is what I've experienced most often before the looking. And so maybe it felt more like going backwards.
Oh, yeah. As far as the life is concerned, you go forwards and backwards and up and down and over. But you must see, Eden, that the very way in which we must speak of these matters gives a lie to the idea that we are touched by them. It is you who experience the feeling of hopelessness and loss. Hopelessness and loss is not you. It is a feeling that you are experiencing. Now, since there is a experience, there is a subject, and it is entirely possible for you to look directly for the subject of this experience rather than at the experience itself, and you'll see that. Okay?
Okay, thank you. Lots of love.
Please stay in touch. I think we have, two more, Carla?
David calling from New York.
Hi, David.
I'm just going to reflect back to you. part of the earlier conversation you had, and I think it comes full circle with what you were talking about with Eden. But here it is, and then you can comment, perhaps. What I heard you say is that glimpses are really past experience. It's the glimpsing, which is present, glimpsing that's the looking, and that is the direct experience of your you-ness. But the glimpses, as soon as you see the glimpse, you're not glimpsing.
Very good. Absolutely the case. I'm really happy. Very incisive. That's absolutely the case. When you see the glimpse, you're not glimpsing. You're looking at memory. You're looking, actually, you're creating a simulation of something that you remember to be the case. Yes, that's very good. Thank you, Dave.
Yeah, and the corollary of that is something really neat that you said on one of the podcasts that I listened to recently, which is that it's not something that you can do generally for long periods of time, and that's not because it's not possible, but it's because often, you know, we turn the glimpsing into, you know, witnessing of glimpsing, and then now you've got an experience, and it's over.
Yeah, that's right, and you know, also it's just because of the fact that attention is naturally fickle and prefers the story about the experience to the experience itself. The experience itself is so ordinary and so not exciting that it's natural for attention to skitter away at the first sign of anything kind of bright and shiny or any of that, right?
Yeah, thank you very much.
You're very welcome, David, and thank you again for reminding us that, and I say this as often as I think of to say it, that the duration of the direct experience is irrelevant. It is the experience, not its duration, and it does not have a direct and immediate consequence necessarily. It's certainly not a direct and immediate consequence that puts an end to fearfulness and anxiety in the life. It's actually the life, the effect of the vichara on the life is over some period of time, and it's not at all what one would expect from reading and delving into spiritual utterance. So, yeah, duration is meaningless. It's very quick. It's the And it does the work. It does the work. Okay, who's next?
Ian calling from Helsinki.
Hi, Ian. Can I help you?
Yeah, hi, John. First of all, I have to tell you that it's the first time I've heard you speak this evening, and so I have to apologize up front that I'm not so familiar with a lot of your terminology and such. But I had a question about my own practice. You've spoken a lot about the looking process, looking into ourselves. And my own practice over the last year or so has been one of just trying to still the mind. So not really much active, well, as much as I've been able to practice anyway, not so much active looking or activity going on, but just a process of stilling the mind. And this has kind of led for me to kind of getting in touch with an awareness. And I would actually say, you mentioned before to one of your callers about the Donness, I think you called it. And actually I don't have the feeling of Ian-ness. It's kind of like a very impersonal awareness that I've just been trying to experience and be in. And I guess this is a practice I've sort of spent a lot of time with over the last while, and I'm curious whether I'm kind of missing something and I should be making it more of an active process, or yeah, I guess just interested to get your thoughts on it.
Well, yeah, this is a good thing to speak about. The practices that have to do with stilling the mind and so forth can be very useful and helpful in the vichara, in that the more mindfulness is cultivated which is what we're speaking of, mindfulness. The more mindfulness that's cultivated, the more skillful we can become at implementing the natural discernment that allows us to recognize what it is that we're looking at when we look at the reality of what we are. However, the practices that encourage and cultivate stillness only go so far, because really all they actually create is an environment and a context in which something truly useful can happen. Stillness itself is useful perhaps as a palliative measure, because it feels better than busyness in the mind. But as far as bringing an end to the fundamental issue of human life, it has little direct usefulness. There are many teachings and many practices, really, that seek to bring about, to evoke no thought, an empty mind, which is the pinnacle of stillness, empty mind, no thought. And there has actually developed quite a fervor about the concept of no thought as being the true state that from which we are free, in which we are free from the endless goad that tells us that we have to have this, like, for example, empty mind, and we have to get rid of that, for example, busy mind. So the state of stillness, absolute stillness of the mind, actually we experience many, many times during the day, even in the waking state, and certainly when in deep sleep. And yet we always reemerge from that. There's a reason that we always reemerge from that. It's because what we are here for is to look. I mean, there's no point to our birth. There's no point to our existence. There's no point to any of it other than our role as the receptors of this amazing, magnificent, incomprehensible display of movement and sound and energy and so forth that is the evolutionary unfolding of consciousness itself. Now, I can't, of course, have the direct experience of what you refer to when you refer to being aware of awareness, but I can tell you that it's my experience in my own life, in my own experience, as well as my experience with a lot of the people that I have spent time with over the last 10 years, that the feeling of being aware of silent awareness is one more feeling state that comes and goes. And it does come and go. The value of trying to get the direct apperception of the reality of Ian, the actual underlying force that gives rise to Ian, without regard to the philosophical understandings that are, you know, they have some validity about empty awareness and silent awareness and so forth. The value of trying with some urgency to get the direct feeling of the force that gives rise to Ian is that all of the states, the good states, the bad states, the spiritual states, the profane states, all of the states are themselves commentaries about you. They're not commentaries about awareness. Awareness itself and the things we speak about when we speak about awareness are commentary about you. Awareness, speaking of awareness, is a commentary about you. But you are here. the force that gives rise to Ian, what Ramana actually called the force of personality, is here always. It's never absent. And since the misunderstanding pertains not to awareness, but to you, it is you that must be looked at to put an end to it. And that's easy. It really is. It doesn't require that we do away with the seeking after stillness and peace, or we do away with the sweetness of the appearance of the experience of awareness or any of that. It doesn't require that we take on any new belief. It doesn't require that we discard other beliefs. All of that is part of the project that we embark upon, trying to get what we need and get rid of what we don't need so that we can get out of this life alive. So there's nothing that you need to stop believing. There's nothing new that you need to believe. All you have to do is just in between all the other things that are happening in your life, once in a while, when you can, when it occurs to you to do so, see if you can not get the actual, direct, uncontaminated apperception of you. Just you. The you-ness of you. And the outcome of that will not be the sudden awakening, or the sudden awakening was the birth that caused all this trouble in the first place, which we remember and kind of wish we could have it to do over again. That's why we seek after sudden awakening. The outcome of the entry into the vichara is not the sudden awakening or self-realization. Life is self-realization. Your life is the realization, the manifestation in form of reality. Or enlightenment. We won't bring you enlightenment either. Enlightenment's a story. What it will do over time is rid you of the underlying conviction that there's something wrong, that there's something I need to do differently than I'm doing, that there are things that I need to get rid of, that there are things that I need to get, that there are things I need to hold on to, because I find myself inexplicably trapped in this life, inexplicably caught in this body, in this mind, and I have to make sure that I am what I should be. And what the vichara, what the conscious turning of attention, seeking to get the direct experience of you, not awareness of you, does is wipe out that misunderstanding. And then everything else, the practices, the sweetness, the emptiness, the clarity, the all of these things can be pursued at will without the need to see them as anything that actually needs to bear fruit beyond the looking at them, without the need for them to actually be true or false. Then the rest of it is all done actually with the opportunity for a much greater level of skillfulness at it than can be the case when we are doing so from the arising of this energy that tells us that the way things are is not the way things should be, that the way I am is not the way I should be, and so forth. I hope that answers your question a little bit. I hope I hear from you some more in the future, too. Okay?
Yes, thank you. I must confess that I had sort of been coming to the conclusion myself that this awareness was the deepest me. But you've definitely given me food for thought, so I'll mull it over, and I really appreciate your sincere and thoughtful answer to my question.
Well, you're very welcome. And the only last piece of parting advice I would give to you is, while you're considering this and mulling it over, just every once in a while see if you can't find the source of the one who is considering this and mulling it over. And then at some point, maybe I'll hear from you about that. Okay, that's it. We're done here, I think. Wow, this has been a long, long meeting. This is maybe the longest online meeting that we've ever had, and I have loved every second of it. I am, as always, filled with gratitude at the willingness of everybody here to attend to this ongoing arising conversation around the possibility of humanity being finished with its insanity. Humanity, insanity, gone. I love you all. Please stay in touch with me. Carla has a couple things to say to you, and then I love you all. Bye.